Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What did it take to get that banana you just had for lunch from the steamy lowlands of Honduras or Guatemala to your table? And what did the bare-knuckled ambition of a Russian Jewish immigrant have to do with it? Samuel Zemuri arrived in Selma, Alabama in 1892 to work in his uncle's store. He was just 14 or 15 years old, but he already had the work-hardened strength of the wheat farm where he was raised, the height to tower over almost everyone he met, and the raw intelligence and ambition to build a global business empire. How he did it and how he dispensed with anything and anyone that stood in his way is the subject of the new biography by Vanity Fair and Rolling Stone contributor Rich Cohen. The book is called The Fish That Ate the Whale, The Life and Times of America's Banana King. Rich, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me.
When you stop and think about it, it's sort of amazing that we are so addicted to bananas in this country, because it's not like they grow on every farm in middle America. They're pretty exotic.
Right. It's a giant conspiracy. Every morning you think you're choosing your own breakfast, but somebody made that decision for you about 100 years ago. Basically, every banana is imported. They outsell apples, but none of them are grown here.
And they're not actually, banana trees are not trees at all.
No, they're plants. They're stems. They grow from a rhizome. And, you know, what looks like a trunk of a tree are just coiled up leaves that open up as a plant grows. So actually, bananas themselves are not a fruit. They're a berry. They also don't have roots, which means that if a really big wind blows, it's going to knock them all down. It's like a bowling alley. So that's why giant banana companies end up owning land everywhere.
And there's a reason also that most bananas resemble all the other bananas we've ever eaten.
Yeah, because when they find a species of banana that they can plant, they're planted by cutting, like you do in your garden. So they take the rhizome and they cut it into pieces and they plant each cutting. So each banana is a clone. It's great for quality control. You get the same banana every time. Problem is that, you know, they're really vulnerable to any kind of disease because they're identical twins, or twins times a billion. So if a disease comes along that kills one banana, it's going to kill them all. And it's funny that you mentioned that, because the banana that Zemuri planted and that the whole banana trade was based on was one banana cloned called the Big Mike, and it went extinct in the early 60s, which was apparently a much more delicious banana and better in every way than the bananas we eat today. For me, it answered why Curious George is so happy in those old books.
He was not getting that same banana that we have.
No.
So initially, Sam Zemuri did all kinds of work. You describe him, though, as greedy for information, which I thought was fascinating because it's exactly the same description that Mark Kurlansky applied to Clarence Birdseye in his new bio. What kinds of ideas did Zemuri get just by observing life near the docks after he moved to Mobile?
Well, he was an immigrant who grew up on a wheat farm in western Russia. And it's hard farming and hard work, and he grew up without money and things that were scarce, and he had these sort of immigrant eyes. And he was able to see value where other people didn't see anything, saw garbage. He was in Selma working at his uncle's store, like you mentioned, and he saw his first banana, and it was sort of love at first sight. He grew up on a wheat farm in western Russia. You see a banana, it's love at first sight. And he went down to Mobile, Alabama, where the big ships came in, to buy his own supply of bananas. He had this crazy idea of selling bananas in Selma. And he watched. He was greedy for information. Like I said, he just watched. He just sat there for a whole day watching the business. And he noticed that they divided the bananas into three piles. And two of the piles went on trains and left. Those were green bananas and bananas that were just turning yellow, or called ripes. A third pile of bananas, the really yellow bananas, the ones you would eat, they were just left in the yard on the wharf. So he went down to the shipping agent, was then the Boston Fruit Company, which became United Fruit. And he asked them, you know, what are those? And they said, those are ripes. And the definition was, one freckle on a banana, it's a turning. Two freckles, it's a ripe. And he said, what do you do with those bananas? He said, we throw them into the sea. They're garbage. No one could ever get them onto the shelves in time to sell them. By the time you get them to the store, they're going to be rotten. So he was the crazy Russian who bought the ripes. He said, I'll buy the garbage. And he was able to see sort of value in what everyone else had seen as trash, based on a really arrogant idea, which is, he was going to be the one guy fast enough to outrun nature and to outrun rot. And, of course, he was wrong. He got him on a train, a boxcar in the Illinois Central, and started bringing him back to Selma, and they started to rot. And he had to sort of improvise. So he worked out a deal where he went to the telegraph operator in a little town, and the guy wired ahead to all the telegraph operators ahead that gave the message in each town that if the peddlers and the supermarket clerks come out to the rail yard, he'll sell them bananas for incredibly cheap right off the backs of the train. And that became his business. He found this niche at the bottom of the business, selling what everyone else considered was garbage, valuing what everybody else considered without value. And by the time he was 18 years old, in the 1890s, he made $100,000 doing that and become kind of a legendary figure in the fruit business.
Well, it's such a testament to his cleverness that, one, first of all, he worked out a deal with that first telegraph operator. He didn't want to pay him cash, so he said, I'll just give you a cut later on.
Right. I don't think he had any cash left. He spent all his money on the bananas in the boxcar. He was completely broke. I mean, he risked everything every time. That was the other amazing thing about him.
Yeah, and the stuff, I mean, in his defense and in the defense of people who were throwing these things away, refrigerated trucks were not available back then.
No, I mean, when they first, well, the first thing they refrigerated was ships. And there's a great guy I write about named Lee Christmas, who was a mercenary soldier. And when he heard that Boston fruit was refrigerating a ship, and the mechanism to refrigerate it was like horsehair, dry ice, and fans. It was a crazy pre-refrigeration. And he said, look at those Yankees, those crazy Yankees refrigerating the ships. But that was, of course, once you could refrigerate the ships, then they put the bananas on the ship, and they the temperature, I think, was 58 degrees, and they call it putting them to sleep. You know, so that completely changed everything. But the banana business at the very early days was wind. And the guys who made it got lucky. They got a good wind, and they somehow brought the bananas into the United States. You know, one of the, because you're in Dallas, the first, supposedly the first load of bananas were brought into Texas, into Galveston, by Zimmerman's father-in-law, who was another legendary guy named Jake the Parrot King Weinberger, who'd gone down to Central America to trade trinkets off a little boat for parrots that he sold to general stores. And he saw these bananas, and he'd never seen anything like it, and he brought the first bunch back to Texas.
I also love that Zimmerman was so all in with that first box load of bananas that he bought that he had to sleep with them.
Yeah. Well, also, he, you know, the, what they would do is they'd rent money in the caboose or whatever, a bed, and he used all his money. So he used all his money on the bananas and on the train. So he had to basically sleep with his bananas. And actually, it's not a coincidental thing. A huge advantage he had. You mentioned the fact that he was tough. He was kind of a cowboy. He had size. He was a mix of all these different types. You know, he was a Russian. He was Jewish. He was a New Orleanian. He was an Alabaman. He was all these different things. But he always wanted to be on the ground with the stuff. So later when he went down to Honduras, Boston fruit was run out of Boston. He lived in the jungle in Honduras, and he used to have this saying. He'd say, you're there, I'm here. I know what's going on. He spoke Spanish. He worked in the fields, and he lived with his men, and he lived with his bananas. And when it came to times when things got very rough, and he was actually in a war with United Fruit, he had this huge advantage, which is he was like a guy who lived on the front lines.
Yeah, and when you say war, it was quite literally, I mean, people were, this was, it got violent.
Yeah, Zimmerman, this immigrant who started with nothing, makes this fortune in ripes. Then he goes down to Honduras, and he builds his own plantations. And he's in Honduras right on the border with Guatemala, and right across the border is United Fruit. And they're fighting over the remaining banana lands and over the market, and they go to war. It was called the Great Banana War. And actually, you know, they had these armies of mercenary soldiers that they called banana cowboys who fought for each side. There was a shooting war. The United Fruit had the world's largest private navy, and the second one was Zimmerman, Coyamel Fruit, what they call the Little Navy. And it actually almost escalated into a war between Guatemala and Honduras. And the U.S. State Department basically called the president of United Fruit and the president of Coyamel Fruit, Sam Zimmerman, to Washington and sat them down and made them make a peace the way you would with two countries, you know, in the Balkans. And the result was that these companies merged, which is how Sam Zimmerman became the fish that ate the whale.
So let's step back a little bit here and talk about how he built up enough money even to have his own fruit company, Coyamel. You write that from his early 20s, he had this amazing charisma that caused people to sort of line up behind him and want to take orders. Can you tell us a little bit about his leadership style?
Well, it's interesting. You know, you read, there's a lot of, he didn't leave a big written record because he had this sense that if you leave a written record, it's the kind of thing that some prosecutor reads out in court just before they send you to jail.
It's a paper trail, and there were reasons for him to fear that.
Right. I mean, so, but the people who met him did. Lee Christmas, who was a mercenary soldier who worked with him to overthrow the government of Honduras. Felix Frankfurter, the famous jurist, and Lillian Hellman, these are all people that knew him and wrote about him. and what you and even Franklin Roosevelt. And what you come across are people were just incredibly impressed by this guy. He was just a larger than life guy, and he was sort of a legend. And it's like, you know, the character, and they speak of in Death of a Salesman. He says he went into the jungle when he was 19, and he came out when he was 21, and by God, he was rich. And that was really Sam Zimuri, and his leadership style was sort of no nonsense, dead ahead. I should say that he was incredibly creative, cursor, swearer. The story was he spoke with no accent except when he swore, but he swore all the time. And he could swear in five different languages, and he was, you know, like a rough guy, uneducated, and he lived with a bunch of guys who were like cowboys in Honduras when it didn't have an extradition treaty to the United States, and it was the original Banana Republic, and it was like Tombstone, Arizona. It was full of criminals and mercenary armies and revolutions. And his style was like, cut the Gordian knot. Don't be smarter than the problem. My father has a saying, he always says, you know, if power is based on perception, if you think you got it, even if you don't got it. And that was Zimuri. He felt powerful, and he was powerful. So, like, one little example of how he led. When he was fighting with United Fruit, United Fruit and his company were both vying for the same piece of land that was right on the border between Guatemala and Honduras. They both did a study, and they both found out that it was actually legally owned by two different people. So United Fruit did what big organizations do. They hired investigators. They hired lawyers. They said, search out and figure out who really owns this thing, and we'll buy it. So Murray just simply went to both and bought it from both.
He just paid twice and then got the land that everybody wanted.
Right, but if you figure out how much United Fruit paid on their lawyers, he still paid less. And that was his thing. He just was a straight-ahead guy whose philosophy was sort of, you know, if I lead, people will follow.
Yeah, it's just extraordinary. It seems as if he never doubted his ability to succeed, starting with the time when he realized, okay, to make the real money, I have to import these things directly. And so he goes out and finds this steamship company that I guess is selling itself for fire sale prices.
Yeah, he found an old, there had been a banana company that had been in and out of bankruptcy, and it was sort of just in court. And they had two old steamships, which had these steamships used to go from Liverpool to Argentina. That was a regular route. So great, such a crazy time. And he bought this company to get these ships. The company was Coyamel Fruit, and they had a little bit of land on the Coyamel River, and it gave him the ships to start importing his own bananas. You know, my grandma always said, a person who buys green bananas believes in the continued existence of the earth. And basically, Zimuri became successful enough that he believed in the future. He started having a family. And then the banana business was all about controlling supply because you were incredibly vulnerable to everything. Revolutions, hurricanes, earthquakes. So you had to have a stable supply, which meant ultimately you had to plant your own bananas. So he went down to Honduras, which was, like I said, like the Wild West, and he started buying up land that was considered junk land by the people there. Because it was the jungle, it was the lowlands, it was where you went to get malaria and die. And he bought it at incredibly low prices with money, all of it borrowed from banks. And when the banks wouldn't give him any more money, he went to the mob, went to the mafia, which was in New Orleans, and he borrowed money from them. So he owes a lot of money to a lot of very dangerous people in Honduras. And the business was a volume business. You had to sell bananas very cheap. And the way they did that whole business, every company, was they basically bribed all the officials in whatever country they were in. It's like the Walmart scandal right now in Mexico. Same thing.
Let me stop you right there. We're going to take a quick break. My guest is author Rich Cohen. He's a contributing editor at Vanity Fair and Rolling Stone and author of the new book, The Fish That Ate the Whale, The Life and Times of America's Banana King. If you'd like to join the conversation, our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. The email address is think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can study a variety of topics such as creative writing, human rights, and the arts. More at smu.edu/MLS.
Yeah. You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're talking this hour with Rich Cohen, author of the new book, The Fish That Ate the Whale, The Life and Times of America's Banana King. Join our conversation by calling in to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, Rich, Zemuri is making all this money down in Honduras and elsewhere, and it stands to reason that at some point the government would want to make money off of him. For a while, he was able to get away with paying a lot of bribes to local officials that were lower than the cost of those taxes. But what happened when all of that was about to come to an end?
Well, basically, Honduras was like, at that moment, was like Greece is today. Mm-hmm. And it owed this gigantic debt, and it made it vulnerable, and it owed it to British banks. So the United States, worried that Britain was going to basically occupy Honduras, came in with J.P. Morgan, the old man himself, to refinance the Honduras' debt, pay off the bankers, and they were going to sit officers, bank officers, in all the ports in Honduras and collect a tax on all incoming equipment, and they would take their cut and give the rest to the government. This would destroy Zemuri's business because he'd have to pay a higher tax on all the farming equipment, and then it would raise the cost of bananas above what United Fruit was selling them for, and that would be it. And he first went and he hired lobbyists to go to Washington to try to convince Congress to prevent this from happening. The Secretary of State was a guy named Philander Knox, and he found out what Zemuri was doing, and he called him to the Washington, to the old executive office building. This is a guy who's only been in the country, you know, for 15 or 20 years. He's a Russian. He speaks with this thick Russian accent. He goes into the old executive office building, and Knox reads in the Riot Act and says, stay out of Honduras, stay out of our foreign policy, stay in New Orleans, where he then lived, and you don't leave. And then Knox got a group of Secret Service agents to follow Zemuri around and make sure he didn't leave New Orleans and follow around Zemuri's cohorts. So at this point, to me, every time Zemuri runs into this thing, which normally you just get knocked down and that's it, you don't get back up. He gets back up. He's like a guy who, he's a gambler. Like, he's a guy who bets all night, you know. He just keeps raising the stakes. And he goes to the Carousel Bar, still a great bar, in the Hotel Monteleone on Royal Street, New Orleans, which then was like, it was like Miami in 1959. It was just a hangout of revolutionists, guys from Central America, soldiers of fortune. It's kind of like the bar scene in Star Wars. That's how I think of it. And he goes in there and he finds this guy, Lee Christmas, who was the most famous mercenary soldier in the Americas. The New York Times called him a real-life Dumas hero. He was a guy, you couldn't make him up. It's a completely insane figure from another era who had a group of people around him who sort of worshipped him. And he was known as the guy who turned the word revolution into a verb. He used to say, let's go revolutin' when he was hired. And Lee Christmas put together a mercenary army that included a guy named Machine Gun Maloney, who would later be the chief of police of New Orleans. And they found this guy, Manuel Bonilla, who was living in a cold water flat near the river in New Orleans. And he had been the president of Honduras, and he'd been forced out in a losing side of a civil war. They hired him. Zemuri bought them an old warship, U.S. Navy warship that had been decommissioned. It had seen action in the Spanish-American War. He snuck them out of New Orleans through Storyville, the red light district, because they were being followed by the Secret Service. They went out in the dead of night through a bordello onto one of Zemuri's yachts. They went out to the Mississippi Sound where they rendezvoused with this other ship, the warship. Zemuri loaded it up with weapons. They went down to Honduras, and with about 100 guys, they attacked. And there was a war that lasted about 1 month, at the end of which Manuel Bonilla was again president of Honduras, and his first official order was to say that Samuel Zemuri does not pay tax in Honduras for 25 years. And that set the conditions for his company, and it also set the model for the CIA. The CIA later studied that as kind of this, you know, fake insurgency that was a model for what we later did in places like Iran and Guatemala, which was, again, United Fruit.
Yeah, let's talk about Guatemala. This wasn't until 1954, but this was, if possible, an even sort of more sinister example of what Zemuri would do to eliminate those who were in his way.
Yeah, well, this is a totally different point in Zemuri's life. Zemuri battled United Fruit and then merged with United Fruit and retired. And then United Fruit was being badly run, and he took over United Fruit from within. To me, that's his second coup. It's like a financial coup. And then after the Second World War, with Zemuri running United Fruit, there were, you know, democratic movements in Guatemala. Guatemala, United Fruit was so powerful, you know, really built by the guys before Zamuri, that they owned 70% of the private land, the banana company.
That's an amazing figure to think about in the entire country.
In the entire country.
Yeah.
They owned the Pacific ports. So if you wanted to ship something from the country, you had to ask permission of United Fruit. They owned the roads. So, you know, they became the great enemy of people like Pablo Neruda and later on Gabriel Garcia Marquez. United Fruit was known as El Pulpo, the octopus. And Zamuri hadn't built that company. He'd taken it over. He'd kind of been a more enlightened guy, but now he was United Fruit. And when Jacobo Arbenz was a guy who became president of Guatemala, and he started to nationalize, rightly, really, some of United Fruit's land because they had all this land and they weren't growing anything on it. And the rule was if you don't grow anything on it in 3 years, the government can take it back and pay you money for it. And they took 100,000 acres from United Fruit and they gave it to peasants. And what Zamuri did and United Fruit did is they hired a guy named Edward Bernays. Now you're like into Mad Men era.
Yeah.
Edward Bernays is considered, he's Sigmund Freud's nephew. He's considered the father of public relations. He made up the word public relations. And they came up with a plan basically to convince the American people, but also convince the CIA, which was basically a new organization, that Guatemala had gone communist and it was a toehold of the Soviets in the Americas.
And let me interrupt you here because Jacobo Arbenz was in fact democratically elected and not particularly an ideologue at all.
No. Jacobo, it's funny as if when they asked those guys, Jacobo Arbenz and the guy right before him, who their model was and who their hero was, it was FDR. And it was throughout the Second World War we had all this propaganda in fighting the war about the four freedoms and how we were different than the Germans, basically. And these guys heard that and believed it. And what his program was very similar to the New Deal. It was based on the New Deal. It was Social Security, minimum wage. Mostly it was stuff like that. So he was basically a moderate leader, but in his coalition there were a couple of communists. And that was used as sort of the pretext to say the whole thing was communist. And they basically sold this idea. It's very similar to Iraq, I think. So with the weapons of mass destruction, here it was this idea that they were communists. And ultimately, the CIA and Dwight Eisenhower became involved, and in 1954, using a plan that was very similar to what Zamuri did by himself in 1911, they used guys like Howard Hunt, who became famous in Watergate, to overthrow Jacobo Arbenz, basically through psychological warfare, convince him there had been a large invasion of his country. They had speakers that played the sound of explosions. They had two or three planes. They had just a few guys. They tried to do the same thing later with Cuba and failed, obviously. That was after Zamuri. But so basically that was, to me, Zamuri's a story of sort of two big coups. The first one I told you about in Honduras put him in the big game, and the second one in Guatemala took him out because it was like Iraq. It was too successful in a way, and people started to ask questions like, well, who did the U.S. government do this for? Did they do it for America or did they do it for the United Fruit? And there were all these connections. So the Secretary of State at the time in 1954 was John Foster Dulles. Eisenhower was president. Before Dulles was Secretary of State, he worked for a law firm called Sullivan Cromwell, where he did the contracts for United Fruit with Guatemala. And his little brother also did work for United Fruit. That was Alan Dulles, and he was head of the CIA. And just the list of the connections is unbelievable.
And the ramifications for Guatemala were really horrific.
We're still living the ramifications for Guatemala. I mean, it's unclear to me how much you could lay at United Fruit or Zamuri's feet because it's so many years later. I mean, and it is a sort of the Ray Bradbury butterfly effect, you know. But they destabilized that country. It's like what happened in Iran. You know, they overthrew Mossadegh and they got put in the Shah. It was the same group of people a year later. But basically led to a civil war in Guatemala where ultimately 200,000 people died. And the civil war went on for years and years and years and years. And now still it's a long-term ramification. It's not clear. You can't say what would have happened otherwise. You know what I mean? Maybe because the country had problems. But they destabilized this country and destroyed it. And the really sad thing about Sam Zamuri, I think, was that he was like came to this country and he got involved in the banana business and the banana wars, and he was so focused on winning that that he didn't see the bigger picture, and then he did. Okay, so when he got old and he looked around, I think he was basically a good person, and he's not hated in Honduras the way Guatemala's United Fruit's hated. Some people separate him because he was a little different.
They do hate him in Nicaragua, is that right?
Well, they hated him in Nicaragua because United Fruit had some of his boats and used his name when he wasn't even there.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it's just funny because he built the best school in Honduras. His family stayed in Honduras. There wasn't his company wasn't racist like United Fruit had been. His children married Hondurans, you know, and they became part of the population. So they have a continuing presence in that part of the world, unlike United Fruit, which was this Boston Brahmin company. It was a different ethic about it. But, you know, it just all became this one big thing. But Zemuri, at the end, I think he did realize the damage it had done, and he tried to make amends. But, of course, you can never make amends for something like that. And it gave his last years a real sadness because, you know, he knew and he understood. I mean, one of the guys who really started United Fruit was a guy who built a railroad across Costa Rica named Minor Keith. And he became one of the richest guys in the country. And his entire fortune was lost in the crash of 1929. And his wife ended up having to take in washing. This was a guy who died about a month before the crash. So as far as he was concerned, he was a rich guy forever. You know, he never had any idea what would happen. He died at the top. Zemuri is like a guy that lived beyond the crash. I mean, not financially, but morally. And he saw what he'd done, and you can just sense in his actions at the end that there was a tremendous amount of regret and even guilt there.
You mentioned earlier that Zemuri built the best school in Honduras. We have an email here from William who says, as a recent grad of Tulane, where you went as well, in New Orleans, I was often told about the connection between the school and United Fruit. I want to know how this connection started and how Zemuri's house became the president's house of Tulane today.
Well, Sam Zemuri, once he got big in the banana business, he moved from Selma to Mobile and then Mobile to New Orleans because that was really one of the centers of the trade and a hugely important Gulf port with all of Central America. And early on, he was always a guy that gave away a lot of money. There used to be a saying in New Orleans, if you want something from Sam Zemuri, ask for it in Spanish. And he built a lot of things. And Tulane then had just moved to where it is now. And it was a smaller, more regional school. And he had this idea that he was going to take Tulane as his cause and build it into this national school. And one of the first things he did was he gave a lot of money to Tulane to set up a center to study tropical diseases. And because that was obviously, if you're in the Isthmus, and even in New Orleans, there were constant yellow fever outbreaks.
Sure.
And then he kept giving money to the school. And when he died, a lot of his money went into the Zemuri Foundation, which still builds tons of things at the school. That house, there's a house where he lived, which is this incredible house at 2 Audubon Place, which is on St. Charles in New Orleans. When he died, he left in his will that it would be left to Tulane, and it's right next to campus, and they made it the official residence of the Tulane president. Zemuri's son, Sam Zemuri Jr., went to Tulane and was one of the star players on the Tulane football team in the 30s when the team was great, captain of the boxing team, and was one of the first casualties in the Second World War from the United States. He died. He was a pilot, and he died on a reconnaissance mission over North Africa. And Zemuri's kids went to the school, and even down to his great-grandkids went to the school. So there's this real connection between the family and the school, and a lot of the buildings at the school are named after him. I'll tell you one quick story which gets at the good and bad of Zemuri, which is when they were first plowing up the fields in Honduras, somebody found this little sort of idol, like a little tchotchke almost.
Mm-hmm.
And he brought it into Zemuri, and he put it on his desk, and Zemuri said, "What is it?" And the guy said, "I don't know what it is, but we keep finding them in the field." And he said, "I'll give you a buck for everyone you bring in here." And he shipped them all back to New Orleans, and that was how Zemuri built the biggest collection of like Mayan artifacts, or one of the biggest in the world, which is now at Tulane. You know, so it's sort of like one generation destroys, and the next generation makes a museum to what's been destroyed.
How did Zemuri run afoul of Huey Long?
Well, Huey Long, it's interesting, because Huey Long and Zemuri are a lot alike. In a way.
Sure.
Zemuri was a real outsider in New Orleans. He was a Russian Jew. There were a lot of Jews in New Orleans, but they were German Jews. And Zemuri couldn't get into any of the clubs, even the Jewish clubs, because he was a Russian Jew. Huey Long was also a guy who couldn't get into the clubs. They were both supporters of FDR, and they were both New Deal Democrats. Basically, Zemurray thought that supported the New Deal and thought the system needed to be reformed so we didn't wind up with a situation like you had in Europe with fascism and Nazism, and you didn't have these mass movements and revolutions. Huey Long, every man a king, believed that the system basically needed to be destroyed. And in him, I think Zemurray recognized the kind of sort of dictators you had in Europe in an American form. And basically, Huey Long was threatening to run against FDR as a third-party candidate, which could really damage FDR's chances. And Zemurray was close to FDR and advisor to FDR, and he began backing politicians opposed to Long. And Long became convinced, knowing Zemurray's history, that Zemurray was going to stage a coup d'etat in Louisiana, similar to what he'd done in Honduras. Machine Gun Maloney, who'd been living in Honduras, came back to New Orleans, and Long actually called him to a public hearing and sort of said, are you here to build an army and, you know, sort of put your own person in power in this state? So they became really blood enemies, and Huey Long in his entire political career only gave one speech about foreign policy, and that was denouncing Sam Zemurray in the Senate.
Did Zemurray have anything to do with Long's demise?
Well, I don't think he did. You know, Long's assassination was mysterious because the guy who supposedly was the assassin had a different caliber gun than the bullets found in Long. Mm-hmm. So the official thing is always that he was sort of killed by accident by his own bodyguards. I actually knew one of the guys who worked for the Justice Department and who investigated it. But what I just did note in the book is everybody that treated Samuel Zemurray badly, everybody that stood in his way or took away something that he thought he was his or humiliated him, like Long did, came to a very bad end. And I would add Huey to that list. Call it a coincidence.
My guest is author Rich Cohen. He's a contributing editor at Vanity Fair and Rolling Stone. His new book is called The Fish That Ate the Whale, The Life and Times of America's Banana King. We'll take your calls after the break and more emails at think@kera.org. The telephone number is 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author Rich Cohen. His new book is called The Fish That Ate the Whale, The Life and Times of America's Banana King. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Rich, Zemurray had left Europe decades before the outbreak of the Second World War, but talk about the connection he felt to Jews in particular who were affected by the Holocaust.
Well, I really think this was a guy from Russia, and the place where he was from in Russia, basically every Jewish person was killed. Mm-hmm. And when he got his family out by working and sending for them, he literally saved their lives, you know. And I think he had this sense of empathy where he looked at these people and didn't think those people could be me, but he sort of thought, those people are me. You know, and this was interesting because he wasn't a guy who wasn't an especially religious person, and being his religion obviously wasn't an all-consuming thing to him because both of his children were married in church. And the Zemurrays that are around now, they're not Jewish. So it wasn't important to him in that way, but he recognized, you know, these people and that this was him. And then early on when he was living in New Orleans and was sort of this legendary guy, Chaim Weizmann, who would become the first president of Israel, heard about him and basically went to him to try to get money from him. And Weizmann was from a similar sort of place in Russia, and they just made this kind of soul connection. And after that, he became a very big giver, a donor to Zionism. And I don't think it was so much because of the cause, but because of the man, you know, his feelings for Weizmann. So he gave money in the 1920s. And then later in the 30s, he actually helped Jews get out of Europe, and he got a whole bunch, helped get a whole bunch of them into the Dominican Republic, where they famously, there was a town of Jews from Europe called Susa, I think. And he was involved in that, and he was involved throughout up until through the War of Independence in 1948, you know, or whatever you want to call it, that made Israel a state. He was involved in one way or another, you know, helping get ships to bring refugees over and basically helping swaying banana republic countries, so-called, to vote in favor of the creation of Israel. Country, if you look at how that vote was passed in the UN, it was a vote to partition Palestine into two countries. The vote was decided by unaligned third world countries, what they call used to call third world countries. A lot of them where bananas were grown. And the story is Zemmuri got on the phone in New Orleans at that mansion and called all the leaders and all the countries where banana was king and sort of cajoled and pressed and did what had to be done to get them to vote yes.
Because initially there was a vote that was taken and, in fact, the resolution did not pass.
Yeah, I mean, you could set a whole play in that little interregnum. What happened is you needed two-thirds vote to carry it. And all the Western countries and all the Eastern Bloc countries voted yes. And all the Muslim countries voted no. So that meant it was going to be decided by this other third of the countries. And in the first vote, it failed. But it was so close that they called for a second vote at the United Nations 72 hours later. And in that moment, Weizmann, who was working on this is like his thing, went to Zemmuri and said, I need your help now more than ever. And Zemmuri, the story is, said, let me go and see which country's votes are for sale. And he went and he came back and he said, they're all for sale, but you can't afford them. So let's just work on the countries where we have real influence. And if you go back and look at the records, because it's all public, you can see a handful of countries, like the Dominican Republic, like Nicaragua, where United Fruit was owned most of the land, changed their vote either from no to abstain or from abstain to in favor. And it was just enough to carry the vote. So I always think somewhere behind the creation of the State of Israel is Sam Zemmuri with his overripe bananas on his boxcar going through the South.
Is there, Rich, is there documentation of that, or is it just a very logical conclusion that you and other scholars have been able to draw?
Well, the documentation is in the diaries of the people who were involved at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So Weizmann wrote about it very, very openly. And all the other Zionist organizations at the time, the Jewish United Fund, the Jewish National Fund, the Zionist Organization of America, those people all wrote books and they wrote about this. And then there were people at the time too complaining of people trying to bribe them. And Harry Truman, who was president then, in his diaries complains about certain American men with influential in that area bringing more influence than he's ever seen in his life on this one issue. And so Zemmuri himself always wanted to keep it hidden for obvious reasons, I think. But he wanted to keep everything hidden. He was like the guy behind the guy behind the guy behind the guy.
Yeah, it
must want to be in public.
It must have made your research process, just for the whole life story of this man, a challenge in that he was perfectly happy without a particularly large public persona, except maybe in the very local sense that he was doing things in places like New Orleans.
Yeah, but even in the local sense, I mean, he really did not, even when he was doing really good things, he didn't want attention. So now his names are on a lot of buildings at Tulane, but that happened after he died.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't want his name out there. When he gave away a lot of money. We can never know how much because he wouldn't let his name be connected to it. And one of the guys involved in this, you know, there was a thing called the Brika, where after the Second World War, there were 1 million Holocaust survivors still living in what had been concentration camps that were now called DP camps. And the Zionist organizations, what would become the leadership of Israel, smuggled a lot of those people out through the British blockade into Palestine. And there's a book by the guy who led that operation. It was called the Brika, and he talked about how much Zemmuri did, and he said his one condition was his name's never to be attached to it. And this was one of the most powerful men in the United States, and he kept his name completely out of the papers during this whole time.
Why do you think he did that?
I think, you know, a really good friend of mine, this guy, a great writer, Ian Fraser, wrote this story once about grizzly bears, and he had a line that I always think of, and it was, "A grizzly bear in the newspaper is a grizzly bear in trouble." And I think he had the same sense. You know, a guy in the newspaper is a guy in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
And if you keep your name out of the papers, you know, it's like the gangsters. I wrote a book about Jewish gangsters like Meyer Lansky. The gangsters that were in the newspaper, like Lucky Luciano, went to prison and were deported. And the ones that stayed out of the paper died of old age. And it's just a survival sense that there's nothing good about being in the newspaper.
Is that why we don't, maybe until the publication of this book, why the name Zamuri is not a household word today the way names like J.P. Morgan and Cornelius Vanderbilt still are?
I think it's two reasons. I think that's definitely one reason. And another reason has nothing really to do with him exactly. It's New Orleans,
mm-hmm.
which is when he came to New Orleans was booming. It was one of the most powerful cities in the country. It was supplanted in a lot of ways by different cities, including Houston, you know, which took its place. When Cuba became embargoed, it lost all its trade to Cuba, and it's just slowly died. The population has gone down since the 50s, when Zamuri really retired, by 50%. And it's become not an important city in the same way that it was. So you have to tell people, Sam Zamuri wasn't a guy working in Charleston, you know, in some little city. New Orleans was one of the most important cities in America, and culturally and economically it was a powerhouse. And he attached his name to that city, and in a way that city kind of, I don't want to say died, because it's a great city, and it's still a great city, and I think it's got a great future, and I love it as much as any city in the world, but in a way it did kind of die. And it's sort of like what happens to you, to your legacy, when you attach your legacy to a city that dies. You know, I always said if he had been in New York, he would be like John D. Rockefeller.
Hmm.
Because in New Orleans, it is a household name.
Yeah.
And I had an event in New Orleans, and like hundreds and hundreds of people came, and they all had these stories about him. You know, so, but he's just, that's just in that one city. Outside of New Orleans, nobody knows who he is.
You know, it's funny, though. It goes back to the point that you make in the book, and I don't know if we've talked about it too much, which was that the United Fruit executives, they were headquartered in Boston, rarely left. He would, perhaps if he had gone to New York, he wouldn't have been as successful as he was.
Yeah, well, the thing about him is, wasn't even that he was in New Orleans, that he lived in Honduras half the year.
Yeah.
And he famously rode across the breadth of Honduras on a mule because he wanted to see every inch of the country. He drank in the dives. He played pokers with, you know, the guys who worked for him. It gave him this on-the-ground knowledge. And actually, you know, now you think, oh, he's maybe this robber baron or something, all these things. But the fact is that for the people in Central America, he was kind of their champion. Because if it wasn't for him, it was just United Fruit. And he was the other company, and he was the hedge against United Fruit, and he spoke Spanish, and he lived there, and he was part of that community. And they made him kind of a champion until he took over United Fruit. Now, at the end of his life, after he took over United Fruit, he did live part of the year in New York. And here's just a little trivia thing if people want to check it out. On the waterfront, the Elia Kazan movie with Marlon Brando is sort of supposed to be United Fruit. They didn't film it. They wanted to film it at the United Fruit docks, but they wouldn't let him. But the movie with Humphrey Bogart called Sabrina, the last scene of that movie is filmed on the old United Fruit dock in New York. And if you watch the last scene where Bogart jumps from the dock to a leaving ship with his love of his life on the ship, in the background you could see Sam Zamuri's office.
Hmm.
And one more thing, which is Bogart didn't actually make the jump himself. He was too drunk by the time they filmed it. They had to have a stunt double.
That's another good piece of trivia. Do you think that, did Sam Zamuri treat his employees well in terms of the way they were paid? I mean, we still have concerns today about agricultural workers, particularly in the developing world. You mentioned he wasn't a racist. That doesn't necessarily mean he paid living wages.
Well, the fact is, and this is the thing people don't like to talk about because the company's become, you know, this sign of evil, but Coyamel Fruit, which Zamuri set up, they paid 10 times at the wage of any other employer in Honduras. That's another reason people love them.
What made him think it was worth it at that point? Because that was an unusual move then. And now,
well, it was still nothing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was 10 times compared to everybody else, but compared to the United States, it was one-tenth.
Yeah.
So because the business was based on low wages, I mean, he wasn't competing with a lot. And also they had, you know, these company compounds, which were like little American towns dropped down in the middle of these foreign countries. And they had hospitals, and they had schools, and they had sanitation. So if you happen to be working at one of those companies and had access to all these things, like free medical care and this much higher wage, it was the best job you could have, which made it even more powerful. And also it made them disliked by local employers because they were messing up the whole wage structure.
Hmm.
You know, so it's really, economically, it's very interesting what they did. It's not so simple as just exploitation. There was a lot of exploitation, but it was more complicated than that, more interesting than that.
Are business students today studying anything about Zemurray's methods?
I wrote a story in the Wall Street Journal about 2 weeks ago called basically the five things you can learn from the Banana Man.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that they should, because I think he was a model businessman and really kind of a genius at business. And the way that he sort of took on and then took over United Fruit and how he did it, which was on the ground and making a better product and looking at a thing. His whole thing was finding value where other people didn't. That was his entire business. It was the ripes with the bananas. Later, it was the land he bought in Honduras that wasn't valued in Honduras. And then later, he had this idea that he was going to grow a better banana than United Fruit, which you would think, I mean, a banana is perfect. How can you improve on a banana? But he actually did through all these kind of agricultural processes. And the traders actually preferred his bananas to United Fruit's bananas. So if you look at his life, what he did in each circumstance, and then the great thing was during the Depression, he was not working, but he was the largest holder of United Fruit stock, and he went to United Fruit, to the board, and he made a plan for what they should do to save that company because it was in big trouble during the Depression. And the board of directors in Boston heard him out, and he was like this Russian guy with a thick Russian accent, uneducated. They had no respect for him. They called him a little fella, even though he was this giant guy. And after he gave his presentation, the chairman of the board, this guy Daniel Gould Wing, laughed and said, "I'm sorry, Mr. Zemurray, but I can't understand a word that you say."
Hmm.
And he stormed out of the room, and they all thought they'd driven him off, and he came back with this bag of proxies. He'd gone around from other shareholders, which gave him control of the company, and he said, "You're all fired. Can you understand that?" And that was what you learned from him, which is he very much was like a game. You know, my father always said, if you play life like a game, you know, and he really did. It was a big game. And that was also the flip side of that was it was too much of a game. He didn't realize the consequences on other people's lives, I think.
We just have a few seconds left. But before this book, you have a book whose title is Tough Jews. Can you talk about your obsession with that subject?
I think because I grew up in it. My father's from Bensonhurst, Brooklyn. He grew up in a neighborhood with like a lot of tough guys and a big variety of sort of Jewish types, if you will. And I grew up in a place where, you know, there was a stereotype about being Jewish, and it meant that you were sort of a guy that was going to go to law school.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't want to go to law school, you know. And I sort of craved these people that were, in a way, bad. Because if being good in the certain kind of way we think of it is predestined by your ethnicity, then your choice to be good has no meaning. So you're not free.
Well, it's a fascinating story, I have to say. Rich Cohen's new book is called The Fish That Ate the Whale, The Life and Times of America's Banana King. Rich, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's great.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect answered the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is senior producer. Learn more about Think and find out about upcoming programs online at kera.org/think. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.